Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Governor Peter Shumlin says the recently concluded legislative session was one of the most productive in recent years, with the passage of the GMO labeling bill, legislation to boost the state minimum wage, and a variety of initiatives that are designed to help create new jobs throughout the state. The governor says he's very proud of the steps that his administration has taken to improve the Vermont economy.
We came into this session determined to grow jobs and prosperity, improve opportunities for middle-class Vermonters, and strengthen our quality of life. Vermont now enjoys the second lowest unemployment rate in America. I might not have told you that before. We've created nearly 11,000 new jobs since 2011.
So how does Republican Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott view the accomplishments of the session, and are there some areas where Scott thinks more could have been done to strengthen the Vermont economy? These are some of the questions we have today for our guest, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. Lieutenant Governor, it's great to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Your thoughts about the session. What were some of the chief highlights for you? Did Republican leaders offer some good alternatives to some of the Democratic priorities this year on the economy, on health care, on property tax reform? Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. But if you've got a question or a comment for the Lieutenant Governor, great opportunity to give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. So the governor in his speech at the end of the legislative session said it was a great session, very productive, particularly for what was done to strengthen the Vermont economy. Do you agree with that analysis?
Well, I'm not sure that I agree totally with the governor on this one. I've always been in the camp of wanting to do more about growing the economy. I think that's an issue that faces all of us, and I think it should be prioritized. And I thought during the session, we should have done more. We introduced, I think there was 1,211 bills that were introduced, and we actually went through those bills to see what bills would have a positive effect on the economy. And we came up with maybe 18 or 20 out of 1,207. Out of that, I believe it was only one or two that really had any effect, positive effect on the economy. And I thought we should be emphasizing that, because it crosses party lines. It doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican or an independent or progressive. We all face the same challenges.
So if the governor was sitting here, he would say, wait a minute, we got that $4.5 million incentive fund, and that actually might help keep IBM in Vermont if it gets sold as a way to keep all those jobs in Vermont. He'd talk about the downtown tax credits, some low-interest loans for startup companies. What should have been done that wasn't done?
Well, again, those are initiatives that are important, and those came out of that the Paul Ralston, Heidi Sherman bill that was introduced in the House early in the year. The Senate took most of the provisions, put it all into S-220 or parts of it, and then it was watered down from there until the last 3 or 4 weeks of the session. And then they came up with the enterprise fund and money that was going to come out of the waterfall, out of the budget, to help in that regard. I think I think those are positive steps. I think those are things we should be doing. But coupled with that, you know, there was some workers' comp language that was tied in that may not help businesses all that much in the short term. Maybe in the long term it will help. But there are other things that I think that we talked about during the session that didn't really help in terms of business initiatives, keeping businesses here and the future of attracting businesses to come to the state. And all the while, we're still talking about single-payer health care. And as I've said in the past, I've been a skeptic. But I'd like to see some of the details, and we never saw the details of that. And those are some of the things that businesses look at when they either are looking to expand here or they're looking to come to the state to set up shop. they look at things about your approach. And I still believe we are known throughout the region, whether it should be substantiated or not, is that we're an anti-business state. And I think that we have to change our image in order to attract more businesses. We are getting attacked from our west, from New York. They're doing a great job in promoting business in New York. And we've always struggled with New Hampshire to our east. With no income tax, no sales tax, it's always been a challenge for those bordering communities to do business.
So do you think the failure of the governor to identify a funding source or a menu of options to finance single payer this session has hurt the business community?
No, I wouldn't say that it's hurt directly, but it's that slow erosion, and it doesn't do much to help entice businesses to come when there's that uncertainty, when there's an angst in terms of whatever it is, whether it's health care or any of the initiatives that we're taking up in Vermont. That doesn't give a great positive feeling for those that want to come here or are looking to come here. You know, 2 years ago when we started the session, I address the Senate, and I would like to read some of what I said because I think it still holds true today, if I might.
Sure.
I'll just skip through certain sections, but somewhat about halfway through, I said, while campaigning, a recurring message I heard, and I'm sure many of you heard, was the anxiety over affordability. The margins are getting smaller, and with a recent 2% rise in the Social Security tax, disposable income has shrunk for all of us in the workforce. Another problem we face is the exodus of our young professionals. According to state census data, our 25 to 44 age group lost 30% of its population in the last decade. That's 28,000 Vermonters who left our state and took with them their buying power, their innovation, and their children. Many of our elementary school classrooms echo with their absence. The question is, what do we do about it? And I've been in business for almost 30 years, and as in any business, there are two sides to the balance sheet, expenses and revenues. We have the same thing here in state government, so we have choices. We can reduce expenses by cutting staff and programs, or we can increase revenues by raising taxes and fees. And for better or worse, we've already done both. What I continue to hear all over the state is that Vermonters are feeling frustrated, tapped out, and taxed out. The governor has said the same, and I suspect many of you have gotten the same feedback. But there is another way to hit both sides of that balance sheet at the same time, and that's by growing our economy. If we can work with businesses, both small and large, to replenish those private sector jobs, progress and prosperity will come. If we can entice young professionals to move here, our classrooms will fill up again, and so will our vacant storefronts, and so will our state coffers. But we need more tools to entice people here than just our incredible quality of life. We're all familiar with the tourism marketing survey completed last year that asked Vermonters what they associate with the word Vermont. Along with the beautiful, unspoiled mountains, we need people to think opportunity.
So some listeners might be wondering, what specifically would you have liked to see this legislature do to achieve some of the goals that you outlined there?
Well, I think we have to address some of the concerns that businesses have. And when I go to talk to businesses, some of the ones we're trying to attract to the state, the high cost of electricity is of major concern. Manufacturing continues to be the backbone. That's where the middle class, that's where the higher paying jobs are for the middle class. And if we're going to entice them to come, whether we're talking about Green Mountain Coffee, or we're talking about IBMs, or we're talking about solar manufacturers, it doesn't really matter. They need reasons to come, and electricity is a major concern to them. IBM in itself pays, I think it's like $3 to $4 million a month in electricity costs. And those are some of the concerns that they have. So we have to address that. We have to address, you know, the workers' comp issues that still face us. Property tax is one that faces businesses as well as individuals. And that's something that we didn't do enough of. We didn't talk about that enough. So, again, we reduced the research and development incentives for businesses, and that was only put into place in 2011. But we already reduced that amount. And those are Green Mountain Coffees of the world take advantage of that. And we need, that's the type of business we need here in Vermont as we move forward. So, again, a positive a business climate. Conducive to growth is something that we is as much about a feeling as it is anything else. And with that, I think we reap benefits, all of us. And I want everyone to prosper more, low income, middle income, and high income alike. And I think that when we can do that, some of our other problems will subside.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Neil in Charlotte. Hi, Neil. Yeah, welcome to the program.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Lieutenant Governor, at the outset of the program, you mentioned the year started with some 1,200 bills, and through prioritization, it got whittled down to 18 or 20. And I'd like your comment on how Lake Champlain cleanup continues to not make the priority list cut. It seems like we're struggling, and the lake is getting worse. It's not even stabilizing. And I just wonder your comments on why that's not getting a higher prioritization in the legislature.
Yeah, I think I can answer in pretty much one word, and it's money. And that's the problem. We all understand, I think we all understand the issue, and that the Lake Champlain is a gem for tourism, for our quality of life, and it's something that we've got to address. I think Governor Douglas tried to do it with the Clean and Clear program. But it just doesn't seem like it's ever enough. And as others that are well more versed than I am on it will tell you that we have to address it now. And that when we, you know, another industry that we don't talk enough about, I don't believe, is, and that we take advantage of, is our tourism. And so we have to make sure that those jewels like Lake Champlain are taken care of. And again, it's all about priority. It's all about where do we come up with the money. And I still believe that if we, and it's very important, but at the same time, we have to grow industry here. And we have to get, you know, our population is stagnant at this point. Our workforce is declined. And we need more people here to pay the bills, and we're losing that middle class. When I stated that before about that age group from 25 to 44 that have decreased by 30%, those are the folks that are paying the bills for us, and we need to do things to address that, to keep our kids here, and to give them opportunities.
Today on the program, our guest is Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. If you've got a question or a comment, might be a good time to talk to Peter in South Burlington. Hi, Peter. What's on your mind?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I called because it sometimes gets tiring to hear only the one side of an issue. For example, the 28,000 people have left Vermont, and, you know, there's no comparison to how many people left New York for another state, or how many people are coming to Vermont to work at Cars.com, or, you know, Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, some of our great companies. You know, one-sided numbers don't really sit well with me.
Well, I'm hoping that I'm not giving one-sided numbers. I think those are actual numbers. Our population is stagnant at this time. It's 620,000 people. Hasn't changed a whole lot in the last decade or so. Those numbers came off the census, and I think that other states are struggling as well in the Northeast. There's no doubt about it. And our electricity rates may be amongst the highest in New England, but they're all high in New England. So our battle, I think our competition is as much to the south in North Carolina, South Carolina. But now we've got a more worldwide economy, and I know that when You look at Energizer that had a reduction in, we closed a plant in Franklin County. We had Kennametal in Lindenville that just announced that they're closing their division. And that 80 or 85 jobs doesn't sound like much, but for them in Lindenville, that's like losing 1,000 jobs in Chittenden County. And then we had Plessant in Bennington County. So it's all over the state. And IBM, of course, that's a question right now. What's going to happen next? And I don't have the answer to that. I think we're all waiting and anticipating if the other shoe is going to drop and what will happen to them. But my point is that it's not great news when we lose those jobs. And it may be because of worldwide restructuring. But when a company is looking at whether to keep a division open in Virginia versus Vermont, and they look at the bottom line and see how much it costs to do business in Vermont compared to Virginia, then, and they choose Virginia because of the lower cost, that doesn't help us any. So we have to be realistic. I know we can't compete toe-to-toe with New York. We don't have the resources, but we have to, again, put up some sort of a fight.
You know, some people might be wondering, right at the top of the newscast, we heard Vermont's unemployment rate, 3.3%, the second lowest rate in the country. That being the case, how bad could things be?
No, it's great that we have a low unemployment rate. But again, the workforce, take the workforce and look at it, that it's shrinking and people are not getting into the workforce. So when we look at the population, look at the real data, that's great news, the unemployment, but we need to look at the workforce. That's the number. And then we have to look at the net of the workforce, not gross, net.
Today on the program, our guest is Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. We're looking back at some of the work of the 2014 legislative session. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211 if you've got a question or a comment for the Lieutenant Governor. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Diane in Shelburne. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just have a quick comment question, which is, has the government or the legislature considered pursuing tax income from third-party motel reservers? In other words, Expedia, Priceline, Travelocity, all those types of things, they take 25 to 45% of our revenues. And my understanding is that they are not taxed on their profit. That's one question. The second question is the viability of Lake Champlain. I would like to see someone investigate the rail lines that go right on the lake, right next to the lake, because we have property there, and those lines are not really very well maintained, and they're certainly not protected against train derailment into the lake.
Okay, Diane. We appreciate your phone call. Do you know anything about the Expedia, the travel sites, and the taxation policies?
You know, we've talked about that for a few years in trying to be able to have that vehicle or a mechanism to tax those online services. And I think that I'm sure it's been considered. I'm sure it will be considered more in the future as we move towards more of that. Whether purchasing from an Amazon.com or purchasing from Expedia and so forth. And I would have a hard time believing that we have not considered that, being that we've looked at a lot of different initiatives and tried to raise revenues. And so I would think that would be fertile ground in the future.
We got this email from Paul, who wants to know, do you think the GMO labeling law will hold up to a court challenge? And what do you think of the governor's idea of soliciting donations from across the country to fund the legal costs that the state will have to bear?
First of all, the question of whether that will stand up or not, I don't know. I know it's probably a reality that we will be sued. It was my viewpoint that I think we should have had a trigger mechanism. I believe that we should know what's in our food, first of all. I want to make sure everyone realizes that. But I would have, much like we did with the mercury labeling legislation 10 years ago, and I was part of that in the Natural Resources Committee when I served in the Senate, and we came up with a way to utilize other states in terms of building up a coalition, and it worked. And there was a lawsuit, but it worked. We weren't out there all alone. And I feel that we could have utilized a mechanism where if other states with a certain population were to get together, that we could have gone in it together and split the costs up for this lawsuit. In terms of soliciting a fund, I haven't been able to put my finger on it, but it just hits me wrong that we should be doing that in state government. I think that we in state government get together, and that's why we have an attorney general and a defense, and we should be able to do that on our own. And I don't think it's healthy in the future to establish these funds and be able to push forward legislation knowing that that we'll have money there, or somebody, whether it's a private firm that will come up and defend us or not with money. I just don't think that's healthy for some reason. And maybe I'm wrong. It just hits me wrong.
You know, a lot of speculation now about who's going to be running for governor in 2014. I know you've said you're going to be seeking re-election as lieutenant governor, that you won't be running for governor this year. Still Representative Heidi Sherman was thought perhaps to be a candidate, but then she said this week that she's going to seek a re-election in the legislature. You know, some people might be wondering, when an incumbent governor like Peter Shumlin has an approval rating under 50% and his disapproval rating is in the low 40s, why isn't there a strong GOP candidate challenging Governor Shumlin?
Well, it's difficult to unseat an incumbent with a pretty sizable war chest, I guess, to add to that. So it's an endeavor that you really have to be realistic about, and you have to be able to raise money. It's difficult to raise money to be able to compete on a head-to-head basis. So I think that that's the struggles that many face when they consider running for governor. But I think there will be a Republican candidate. I don't know what Randy Brock is doing. Scott Milne has somewhat thrown a line out there to see what might be available. And so we'll see what happens. But I'm confident that there will be a candidate.
Are you encouraging Scott Milne to run?
Well, Scott, I've known Scott for quite some time, known as family. He grew up in Barrie, as I did. And so we know a lot of the same people. And I have a lot of respect for what he's done with his business. And he's got name recognition, and he's a bright guy. And it's totally up to him. I haven't been encouraging him, but I did. He came in to talk to me about it. And so we'll see what happens.
Do you think the state needs to go in a different direction starting in 2014? I'm looking at you as the presiding officer of the Senate. You're a member of the governor's cabinet. You're in a very unusual situation. As you look at this gubernatorial race, would the state be better off if one of these credible Republican candidates actually won the election?
Well, yeah, I think it would be. Myself personally think it would be better, but at the same time, I think what we need in Montpelier in the legislature is a little more balance. And I think we need people from all persuasions to run, but at the end of the day, Republicans haven't done very well in some of the legislative races in the Senate and the House, and we need to build those numbers so that it gets more towards a better balance, so it's not a supermajority, so that there is a voice of opposition and something credible, so that gives folks choices.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you thought the state would be better off if Randy Brock, Scott Milne, whoever the credible Republican candidate is, if you think that's a good thing to have happen and kind of shift the state in a different direction.
Well, I still think you have to. I don't know if that in itself will shift the state in a different direction. I think you need a legislature, and I think you need to people to step up and voice their concerns in order to shift the direction we're going in right now. And that means building more balance in the legislature.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to John in Richmond. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Earlier, your conversation was talking about the competitive disadvantages with, say, states in the South, and oftentimes states like North Carolina can have a more attractive tax structure because they're not investing in education. Their school systems, frankly, don't compare to ours. That being said, we're taking this high road where we're protecting the environment and doing all the right things, but we're not investing in the future. We're not with the 1% raise in the allocation to UVM and the state colleges keeps us, you know, solidly in 49th place in the, you know, in allocations on a statewide basis across the nation to our universities. I don't see how it gets better without a concerted effort on all parts, a bipartisan, tripartisan, whatever you want to call it, effort to do that. But I don't see anybody leading that. I'm just wondering what the Lieutenant Governor's opinion on that subject might be.
Well, again, I have a tremendous amount of respect for the Appropriations Committee and the struggles that they face as they try to build this budget. Senator Jane Kitchell, I thought, did a great job in leading that and has a great amount of knowledge in different areas, and I thought her expertise was well-suited. So there's only so much money to go around, and as I spoke about before, you know, it's a question of whether you put the cart before the horse or what direction you go into first. And I still believe that we need to pull together in the same direction in terms of economic building the economy. And I think that should be on the front burner. And then you'll have some resources in order to give more money to higher ed, which I think you know we're woefully inadequate in that area. But there's only so much money to go around, and we want to do so many different things, and we want to help in so many different ways. And I think it's part of our makeup for better or for worse in Vermont. I think we're very compassionate people, and we want to help those in need, and we want to help preserve what we have and the traditions and so forth. But something's got to give. And I feel that we need to focus more on growing the economy in order to have more resources and revenue to do some of the initiatives that we hold so near and dear to our hearts.
You said earlier in the program that you didn't think enough had been done during this legislative session on property tax reform. Specifically, what did you want to see happen in order to keep the statewide property tax rate down?
Well, I think we have to have a you know, not at the 11th hour, having a discussion about what type of a property tax relief and where we're going to move in the future in terms of consolidation and so forth and our overall education policies. And we literally, it was the 11th and a half hour, there was an initiative to we've got to do something. And it failed in the end. And I think that it probably should have, because it wasn't as thought out as it should have been. But it, you know, that should have been started 2 years ago.
So the House had a mandatory plan. They gave smaller school districts 4 years to consolidate. If it didn't happen after 4 years, it was going to be a special committee that would do a mandatory consolidation. The Senate took a much more voluntary mm-hmm. approach. In your mind, does it need to be mandatory?
Well, again, that was just one piece of the overall puzzle in terms of how are we going to live within our means in terms of education financing and property taxes. And I don't believe that we've done that. And I'm not sure that even if that had passed in either version, it would have done enough to reduce property taxes. I think we need to look at this thing in a much broader perspective. And this is something that it is going to take time. But this didn't happen overnight. We have had Vermonters that are struggling. And as I travel throughout Vermont, and I've mentioned this over and over, I talk to an awful lot of people that are working two and three jobs, trying to make ends meet, trying to put fuel in their tanks, fuel tanks, oil tanks for heat, trying to put gas in their cars. And then on top of that, trying to pay their property taxes or pay for rent. So they're struggling, and we need to do something to help them in terms of economic vitality.
We've got about a minute left. We've got this email coming in from Mark. We were talking earlier about the fact that the governor did not unveil a financing plan for single payer this year. And Mark wants to know, what do you think about the lawsuit filed by Cynthia Browning, Arlington representative, to force the Shumlin administration to release the information that they do have right now? Do you think it's a good idea, or do you think it's more of a political ploy?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a political ploy. I think Cynthia Browning feels very strongly about her initiative, and she's been talking about it for quite some time. And I think that we should have the information. I think we should have had it long before now. But at this point in time, I just want us to move forward. I want us to be transparent. I want us to have the information. And if the single payer initiative isn't going to work, then we should just deal with that and see what does work for Vermont, so that we can again give some security, provide some certainty to businesses and Vermonters as we move forward throughout the next year. They don't have that certainty right now, and there's a lot of angst out there, and what we're doing right now isn't working.
We're going to be following many of these issues in the weeks and months to come. Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up next, I'll talk with President Obama's Energy Secretary, Ernest Moniz, about his thoughts on developing new energy sources in New England. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. National Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz is in Vermont today, participating in a special climate change panel at Middlebury College. He's addressing the energy efficiency and renewable energy goals of the Obama administration as part of the president's overall climate change initiative. I had a chance to speak with Secretary Moniz about some of the unique energy issues that face New England.
Well, of course, in this winter, the main problem in major parts of New England was the inadequate natural gas infrastructure for bringing gas during those cold periods, and so as you know, gas prices in New England shot way up. A lot of the generators had to do fuel switching to oil to get through. Fortunately, we did, and I want to credit the New England ISO, the system operator, for really preparing for the winter with making sure that oil was available. Of course, we'd rather not switch to oil for both cost and environmental reasons. But New England needs to have some infrastructure development, which doesn't mean only gas. I mean, there's various ways of approaching the underlying problem with, of course, additional efficiency measures, alternative sources, can be renewables, bringing in electricity. Of course, we already have hydro from Quebec, for example, but we need to take a systematic, integrated view as to how we do that. We are doing that nationally this year at the department with what's called the Quadrennial Energy Review, focusing on energy infrastructure challenges and bottlenecks, how we make an infrastructure that's smart, resilient, meets 21st century challenges. So that's a big effort. Of course, here in Vermont, Vermont's been, as you and your listeners, I think, know very well, Vermont has been a leader in terms of things like smart grid, energy efficiency, photovoltaics, a lot of the measures that we will be seeing more of nationally.
You know, we've got a big natural gas pipeline being considered along the western border of Vermont. Is that the kind of project that you're thinking that it's needed in this region?
Well, I don't know the specifics of that. What I'm talking about mainly is for at least many parts of New England, it's an issue of, for example, the all that gas being produced in Pennsylvania, for example, has natural markets in the East Coast, but the pipeline capacity to bring it up to New England is not yet adequate.
You know, there's some people who hear you talk about larger energy infrastructure, and they say, actually, you know, the first thing we should do is make big investments in energy conservation and energy efficiency programs, and then see if the infrastructure is needed. What would you say to those folks?
Oh, well, I always put energy efficiency number one in the list. In fact, as an aside, I might say that in our request to Congress this year for our next fiscal year budget, in a very tight time, as you know, essentially there's a flat budget across the government, but we went in for an almost 50% increase in our energy efficiency budget. So we think this is critical. I've said many times that in the end, it's hard for me to imagine a solution to the climate change challenges that we have without a major demand-side contribution.
You know, you've talked a lot about the potential for natural gas. Do you think it might be a mistake to rely so heavily in the future on this source of energy?
Well, there are concerns if the fuel mix becomes too much in terms of any one source that includes gas. What it does, it, for example, again, in the New England case this winter, when you had these enormous price spikes in gas. By the way, it was I should clarify it was not unique to New England. For example, if you go down into the New Jersey area, there were also tremendous price spikes. And so, if you're all in on one fuel, like natural gas, you are more exposed to volatility in that case. So certainly having some diversity, building on top of strong efficiency programs is certainly, I think, a good way to go.
As you're probably aware, Vermont gets 2/3 of its electricity from a nuclear power plant in New Hampshire and, as you mentioned, the hydro facilities in Quebec. And so the state's carbon footprint for electricity is one of the smallest in the country. And as a result, the state's transportation sector and the home heating sector are responsible for the largest percentage of emissions. What steps can the state take to deal with this reality?
Well, in each of those sectors, I would mention, in fact, there's a discussion right now going on with the Vermont congressional delegation in terms of looking at more cold weather heat pumps, for example. That, of course, to have the system impact that we would like also then calls upon having clean electricity, which, as you've just said, you do have. So that's an example in the home heating sector that looks quite promising. Transportation, of course, here there's, again, Vermont has been a leader in terms of smart grids. Now smart grid integration with electric vehicles makes a lot of sense. So I think, you know, again, Vermont has got options, and first of all has had the innovative policy approaches, I think, to pursue those options. And the Department of Energy has been very pleased to be a partner with Vermont in many of those activities.
Do you think that some of the energy policies in Vermont serve as a model for other states?
Absolutely. In fact, I've already seen how the energy efficiency utility here fundamentally has been a model in D.C., by the way, and in Ohio, where the experiences here are being propagated very, very effectively elsewhere.
You know, recently the White House released the National Climate Assessment Report, and it concludes that the world is already feeling the effects of climate change through rising temperatures, rising sea levels, and then we see increased precipitation in some areas of the country, huge droughts in others. How long do you think we have to deal with this problem? Several years, several decades? What's your sense of urgency with this?
I would say all of the above. That is, first of all, We've been saying, the president said in his climate action plan, that we are already experiencing the effects of warming. That was last June, where he emphasized that we would have to pick up our game on adapting, even as we focus on the most critical aspect, which is mitigating the climate impacts. I believe that this decade is very, very important. The IPCC report that came out a couple of months ago emphasized, or really re-emphasized, they weren't the first to give the message, that the longer we wait in taking strong measures on carbon reduction, the more difficult and more expensive it's going to be. So we have to move in this decade. The president set out a goal for the United States of around a 17% reduction by 2020. We're about halfway there, and we're going to push hard. Of course, as always in these cases, the second half is always harder than the first half, but we'll keep pushing. But after we pass 2020, we're going to have to go to even steeper reductions. So we will need to keep going today and the next years with the technology innovation that will continue to drive down costs of the zero carbon and low carbon options. So it's going to be it's not something that you do one lap around the track and you're finished. We're going to keep it's going to be a lot of laps going on for a long time, because we will we'll have to continuously drive down greenhouse gas emissions over these next decades.
Do you think you can achieve those goals without imposing a carbon tax?
There are many ways to approach limits on carbon reduction. We have been, compared to other countries, somewhat fortunate in these last years, in the sense that a market-driven approach, because of our low gas prices, substituting for coal, contributed significantly to our progress so far on CO2 reductions. But as we want to go to lower and lower levels, it's clear we will need policy drivers. Of course, right now, from the climate action plan that the president put forward, the EPA, for example, has put out draft standards for new coal plants. They're working on standards for existing coal plants. So there are many policy instruments, but I would say we certainly are going to need policy instruments. And I think it's pretty clear eventually we will need legislation of some form to have a kind of a coherent system-wide, economy-wide approach to carbon reductions. In the meantime, the president has said we can't wait, and so we are pursuing all that we can through administrative actions, through authorities we already possess, but we will need to move to legislation at some point.
Mr. Secretary, many thanks for being with us today.
Great. Thank you, Bob.
Well, this week, the impact of bills that were passed during this legislative session is beginning to be understood. Specific policy and training guidelines will now be required for the use of tasers by police, and a clerical error in a new law governing contribution limits to political candidates means the legislation won't take effect until after the next election. Meanwhile, the state is prepared to spend millions of dollars to keep jobs at the IBM plant in Essex Junction. Also, a national study released this week paints Vermont as a bright spot in an otherwise disappointing landscape of early education. And the recent death of a 15-month-old Winooski boy has prompted calls for further review of the Department for Children and Families. These are some of the voices in the news this week.
The piece that we were concerned with was making sure that the policy struck a balance between what law enforcement needs and protection of the public.
It is also entirely possible that a judge could look at the way the law was written and say, but that is what the law says. And I wouldn't want to be in the Attorney General's shoes to try to enforce the law as it currently stands.
We can't match the dollar amounts that a state the size of New York can offer, but in conjunction with the quality of our workforce, the quality of life, and the other economic development incentives we could put forth, we can make a good case.
2013 was the first year on record that we have seen state pre-K enrollment decline. Notable for moving ahead would be Vermont and Iowa, two much smaller states than those that fell behind.
I'm still concerned that there isn't really a thorough review happening properly, and maybe that's just my being alarmist in nature, but I'm not assured that we're truly getting an independent study being done.
And you can explore each of these stories in depth at vpr.net, where you can also stay on top of news developing all day long. That's Vermont Edition for today. On Monday, the recent homicides of two Vermont toddlers have fueled emotion and criticism of the Department for Children and Families. DCF had caseworkers in contact with both families before the deaths. On the next Vermont Edition, the commissioner of the department is our guest to discuss how child abuse is investigated and the authority caseworkers have when abuse is suspected. Join us Monday at noon. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Sengary, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Devin Karambolis. Peter Biello directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.